Welcome back to the program. Perhaps the recent economic crisis reminded us, particularly with respect to the financial sector, but certainly across the board in business, that corporations and businesses matter. We've seen the balance of power over the years between government and business, the breakup of Standard Oil in the Gilded Age, the breakup of IBM, the government's battles against Microsoft. All reflects what happens when companies are perceived to be too big. But today, sitting atop the corporate colossus, is the giant of ExxonMobil, a company whose politics, policies, and personalities make it literally an empire unto itself. Perhaps Ned Beatty put it best in the movie Network.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Today we're going to talk about ExxonMobil with my guest Steve Cole. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, most recently the author of the New York Times bestseller The Bin Ladens and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars. He worked for 20 years at The Washington Post, where he received a Pulitzer Prize. He's traveled widely as a foreign correspondent, served as the Post's managing editor, and is the president of the New American Foundation. It is my pleasure to welcome Steve Cole back to this program to talk about his new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil, an American Power. Steve Cole, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. I want to begin by talking a little bit about the relationship between oil companies, and American power pre-9/11 and post-9/11. What changed in that regard?
Well, probably the biggest thing was the invasion of Iraq that arose out of the sense of insecurity that the Bush administration allowed itself to feel about the Saddam Hussein regime, or the demonstration project that Vice President Cheney wanted to make to show the world that American power was awesome and simply had to be accounted for in new ways. And so, you know, the invasion of Iraq just changed the global oil industry because it involved the United States driving its army into the heart of the world's largest oil patch in the Gulf. And it also, I think, pushed a lot of companies as along a trend line they were already on, but even faster into Africa as a way almost to get out of the way of the Iraq war. You know, I was surprised to learn that during the decade after 9/11, about a quarter of ExxonMobil's oil and gas liquids production came from West Africa, from Equatorial Guinea, Chad, Nigeria, Angola, and that was true for the United States as a country as well. We ended up moving from the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Guinea.
One of the things you point out is that ExxonMobil was really not for the Iraq war initially because it potentially undermined stability in the region.
Yeah, as you pointed out in your intro, I mean, they're sort of a country unto themselves. They have their own foreign policies, and their basic foreign policy is we want a world that is stable and friendly for oil and gas companies. That's their overriding interest. And so invading oil-rich countries and throwing the Middle East into turmoil is not good for stability. Now, once it happened, they sat patiently, looked for opportunity, and ended up profiting from the war in the sense that before the war, they were not in Iraq, and after the war calmed down in 2009, they won contracts there, and today they produce oil in southern Iraq and in they've just signed a new agreement to go into the Kurdish territory. So we have to take their opposition to the war in the context of also recognizing that they've benefited from it.
Their opposition to the war in that context is really part of this larger issue of them having essentially a foreign policy unto themselves, that they are in the business of trying to find where they can take advantage, regardless of what individual nations might be doing at any given time.
Yes, and also the world for them is not static either. They look out at their basic purpose as an independent country, let's say, and that is to find more oil and gas that they can own. And their big strategic problem is that the big pools of safe, easily accessed oil in the Middle East that they used to own in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, in Iran back in the 60s, they can't get that oil anymore because of nationalism and the assertion of policies in many parts of the world that basically say we don't want foreign companies to own our oil and gas. So with the big pools closed, they get driven more and more into high-risk frontiers, weak states that are politically unstable, often racked by small wars of one sort or another, or into geological frontiers like deep water or north of the Arctic Circle, where the risks of producing are higher than ever. So it's they're in a kind of restless pattern where they have to keep replacing the very large amounts of oil and gas they produce and sell each year, but the horizons on which they can find that oil and gas are often shrinking.
How have they been impacted by the broader sense of globalization? You talk about the resource nationalism that has certainly been an obstacle to them. What about the broader global free flow of money and information?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it has lots of effects on them. It certainly makes them a more vulnerable company to citizen campaigning, because one of the effects of globalization has been to empower citizens with information and to mobilize them when they want to oppose concentrated power of the sort that corporations working in, say, West Africa represent. So they're living in a fishbowl, in a sense, an information fishbowl that they could have ignored a generation ago. I think there's another effect along these sovereignty lines that we've been talking about, which is during the Cold War, a lot of the big American corporations that your great clip referred to from network, you know, IT&T and AT&T, you know, they were tethered to our national system in competition with the Soviet system. And there was, I think, a closer alignment between multinationals and the United States government during the Cold War. One of the effects of globalization has been to spread these companies out and really disperse them from alignment with any national government, including the United States. And so ExxonMobil, I think even more than during the 60s, is organized and sees itself as an independent force in the world, and globalization is responsible for that.
I mean, perhaps the penultimate example of that is a story you tell about a conversation between Lee Raymond, the former CEO, the longtime CEO of ExxonMobil, and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, they met at the New York Stock Exchange in 2003, and ExxonMobil was negotiating to purchase a stake in what was then Russia's largest private oil company called Yukos. And Raymond sought the meeting with Putin to say, look, if I'm going to make this deal, I want to own a majority in this company, this Russian company, and I want to make sure you're comfortable with that. And Putin says, well, if you own a majority, does that mean if I want to do anything with this company, I need to ask your permission? And Raymond says, yeah, well, that's not so bad. It's like that in a lot of places in the world. And you can imagine saying that to Vladimir Putin. Well, Putin declined to go forward with the arrangement for reasons you can probably understand.
And on the other side, you see the relationship between Dick Cheney and Lee Raymond.
Yeah, and so both things are true. They're independent,
right,
and yet they also trade favors with the United States government when it suits them. So Raymond, and the most vivid example of that was the personal friendship between Raymond and Cheney. They had known each other during the 90s when Cheney ran Halliburton and Raymond was running ExxonMobil. They were neighbors in Dallas. Their wives became friendly. They were very close personally. So when Cheney became vice president, ExxonMobil, through Raymond, had a unique back channel to the White House. And it, you know, almost worked just as you would think of it in the cartoon version. When Raymond saw an opportunity for Cheney to make a phone call to help ExxonMobil win a contract at the United Arab Emirates, for example, he did that, and Exxon won the deal. When Raymond was in town, he might go over to the White House and sit down, and they'd just trade notes about oil countries they'd just been visiting or what was happening inside the palace in Saudi Arabia, or he'd go out and have dinner at the vice president's residence. And so they really did have unique, aligned access to the United States, and yet they operated independently at the same time.
And part of what makes that independent culture tick, and you write a lot about this, is the internal discipline within the company, almost a military-like discipline.
Yeah, I came to think of them as sort of similar to the Marine Corps in a lot of ways. The discipline is one part of it, and also the sort of life culture. You come in out of university or graduate school, and there's a kind of up or out moment after six, 6 or 7 years. If you stay, then you're there for life. And at the top of the company are a lot of people who have, you know, risen together as a cohort. You know, if you looked at most corporations, look at the top 30 or 40 positions, you'd probably find a fair number of people who had come in late in their careers from another industry or from a competing company, and they come in with fresh ideas and a reforming spirit. At ExxonMobil, there's virtually no one of that type. It's much more like the military. You don't have a successful career at IBM and then become a two-star general in the Marine Corps because you've been a good businessman, and that's the way ExxonMobil sees itself.
Given, then, the insular nature of the company, how does it stay one step ahead? I mean, we see, for example, I mean, perhaps the extreme opposite in technology, where there's constant churn, constant turnover, and new ideas coming in as a result. How does a company so insular stay ahead of the game?
Well, it's a big question about them looking out. But basically, they've got a very durable and stable business model. So the production of oil and gas has been fundamental to our energy economy for decades and looks like it will be for decades more. So that gives them a relatively stable platform. Second, their operating discipline, which arises from their insularity, the fact that they are on time and on budget much more often than most corporations, that they have a internal system of investment and capital deployment and technology development that is very effective. You know, that gives them an edge as well. You know, over time, are they going to be able to recruit and retain the very best scientists? I mean, scientists, after all, pretty independent-minded lot, and they don't like to work in rule-bound settings by and large. And you know, are they going to be able to innovate enough to keep this edge for another 30 or 40 years? I think it's a question.
And in terms of innovation, one of the things that you talk about is their commitment, or what has been their commitment, to basically bringing oil out of the ground. They're an oil company more than they are an energy company, although with the addition of natural gas, that's starting to change a little bit.
Yes, that's correct. And they very much see themselves, as you say, as an oil and gas purist company. They take pride in the fact that they don't pretend to be something else. They're not trying to fool people with you know, solar plants or windmills that they don't believe in. And they believe that they genuinely believe, almost in a missionary sense, that they are doing the world and the United States a profound public service just by focusing profitably on the extraction and delivery of oil and gas. And until somebody tells them otherwise, that's what they're going to do.
What surprised you about the complexity of their business?
The awesome integrated scale of the global energy economy is just something to behold. You know, the more you understand how these industrial systems associated with oil and gas production around the world have spread and grown, how they're growing still to serve new consuming societies like China and India, and the risks that are associated with these industrial systems day to day. All you have to do is just visit any refinery, any oil terminal, a liquefied natural gas plant, and you almost feel like you're in a science fiction movie, the scale of these operations. And then to think about a single corporation with $450 billion in revenue around industrial activity on that scale, it is mind-boggling. It's hard to visualize.
Talk about the management of it. Lee Raymond, who's really a central character in Private Empire, the longtime CEO of ExxonMobil, talk about the process of managing an operation on that scale.
Well, they changed their approach to that after the Exxon Valdez disaster, which exposed a lot of weaknesses in their management culture. And their main response to reform was to automate and to create a culture of rules and accountability that would try to wring out the role of the place of human fallibility in their industrial systems to the greatest possible degree. And this required their employees over time to adapt and accept you know, a system of rules and manuals. It was all called the Operations Integrity Management System, OIMS, that was, you know, confining but very clear. If you were a rule kind of person, you knew exactly what you were supposed to do. You might have a lot of paperwork associated with it. But by and large, this emphasis on discipline, the philosophy was, okay, we need it in order to prevent another Valdez and to get our safety culture right, but it will bleed over into everything else we do. It'll bleed over into our financial performance and ultimately our profit performance.
Talk about their public relations perspective. And in many ways, certainly under Lee Raymond, different now under Rex Tillerson, the current CEO, they didn't really care what people thought of them.
Yeah, I mean, they'd wrestled for some time, and it was interesting to think about this, with the basic dilemma of being so unpopular. What do you do about it? And, you know, some of the time they told themselves, well, it doesn't matter. We look at our record, look at our profits. Obviously, we're getting along okay, even though we're not popular. It's just the price of doing business. Other times they'd think, well, maybe we can do better, and they'd study the problem, and they'd see that their unpopularity tended to correlate with gasoline prices at the pump, which they really couldn't control. So then what do you do? And they kind of ended up in a defensive crouch, and they judged that it was in their business interests just to keep as low a profile as possible, since they didn't seem to be able to correct their image. And they do that by, you know, as they joke themselves, saying no comment in 50 different languages.
Right. And this is one of the ironies, that on the one hand, they have this attitude that they don't care, that they're in this resource business, and yet they're in a consumer business right up front in the consumer's face every day.
Yeah, absolutely. They are a kind of utility in our society. I mean, we can't escape from our cars. We can't escape from our dependence on gasoline. If we're commuting to work, we can't change the length of our commute just because prices went up. We have to. Most of us have to drive to the grocery store, and yet, you know, if you turn on the light switch and generate electric power, a company will make money off of that. But we recognize that the provision of electric power is so central to our economy that we should regulate its providers in the public interest through utility commissions and various other kinds of oversight that doesn't apply to gasoline. So even though gasoline is a kind of utility function in our economy, the company that provides it is this vast, independent, and very kind of prickly and proud of its independence, a corporate nation unto itself. So it's kind of an accident of American history that we ended up with electricity being generated under a public interest standard and gasoline being provided by this defiantly independent corporation.
One of the things that has been particularly complex about the company is its attitudes towards global warming, towards climate change. Talk a little about that, Steve.
Well, at the time of the Kyoto Accords, which was the global treaty to try to address climate change in 1997, Lee Raymond was running the company, and he gave a speech in which he basically said he didn't believe the world was warming at all, never mind that industrial activity was causing it. He thought there was an equal risk of an ice age as of a warming planet. And from that set of beliefs, he funded a very aggressive campaign to cast doubt on the emerging mainstream science about warming and its causes. And I think the campaign was effective, really created a lot of persistent doubt in the public mind about science that actually its practitioners, its scientists themselves, think is increasingly quite clear, and there really isn't much disagreement about it. After the Raymond era, they did ease up. They changed their strategy. They didn't want to admit that what they'd done in the past was wrong and perhaps invite lawsuits by making such an admission. For a while, their message was, we were never wrong, we were only misunderstood. Then in 2009, they did come out in support of a carbon tax. For the first time, our largest oil company has said that the risks of global warming are severe enough to warrant enacting a price on carbon to incent movement away from oil and coal. Their executives still are not full-throated in acknowledging that industrial activity is causing warming and that if unchecked, the risks to human civilization could be severe, but at least they have moved and are, on paper anyway, prepared to be part of a bargain that would finally enact climate change legislation in this country.
What changed for the company? Obviously, CEO changed. Did Lee Raymond really believe climate change was phony science?
I think he did. I mean, I interviewed him for the book, and we talked about it. I remember walking back to my car after one of our interviews, and I was flying back to the East Coast from Texas, and he said, I hear it's snowing. It's terrible back there. I guess this warming, go ask Al Gore about that, or some record snow, I guess, the day I was flying. So I think he does personally retain a conviction that he was right about this, to be skeptical. He is a very talented chemical engineer with a doctoral degree, was mentored by one of the great chemical engineers in our university systems, and so he has a high degree of confidence in his own scientific judgment. Of course, he's not a climatologist, so but that doesn't seem to bother, that didn't restrain his judgment. Why did they change? I think in addition to the departure of Raymond, public and shareholder campaigning and environmental campaigning, calling attention to the extremely aggressive investments that ExxonMobil was making in these groups calling science into question, did embarrass them, and it created reputational problems for them that their board of directors and other executives at the company didn't want to persist in.
There was also the fear, as you touched on a few moments ago, the fear of lawsuits, the fact that they could be looked on and sued ultimately like the tobacco companies were.
There was certainly, they're a very lawyered company, and some of their critics were comparing them to the tobacco companies, even though there isn't yet any evidence comparable to what we learned about the tobacco companies, that those companies had science inside their own labs showing that smoking was dangerous and repressed it. You know, we don't know that about ExxonMobil's global warming science, but those lawsuits haven't gone very far forward. Perhaps someday they will, and documents will be unearthed of a similar character. But essentially, yes, there were enough threats and even preliminary lawsuits being filed trying to hold oil corporations to account for warming that I'm sure contributed to the cautious language that they brought forward.
Talk a little bit about their lobbying efforts. Certainly, as you talk about, tax legislation is job number one as far as ExxonMobil is concerned. What else are they concerned about in terms of U.S. public policy?
Well, climate change has been the other big piece on the table for them over the last 5 or 10 years, and they've done a pretty good job of getting an outcome that they wanted there. These days, the single most important issue is the regulation of fracking, the production of unconventional gas, where ExxonMobil has made big investments in the last couple of years, and where they are facing a lot of anxiety and environmental doubts about land use damage and damage to water supplies, and even possibly inducing seismic earthquakes and as a result of these techniques. So for their business, the biggest regulatory issue ahead is how fracking will actually be regulated at the federal level and at the state level.
Steve Call, the book is Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Steve, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. Great questions.
Thank you.